Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of How's the Pressure? I am your host, Haley Winter, and this week we have a great show for you. I'm bringing in Walt Fritz to talk about MFR, which stands for myofascial release. Now, Walt Fritz is a licensed physical therapist with a BS in physical therapy and a BA in community mental health. He has been a physical therapist since 1985 and has taught myofascial release continuing education since 1995. Now, Walt also operates the Pain Relief Center in Rochester, New York, where he sees both local clients as well as clients who travel from across the country. Now, I really enjoyed my conversation with Walt. He is clear, specific, and concise. And in this episode, we cover a number of subtopics around the myofascial release, including why he started practicing it as a physical therapist and how his relationship with the work has changed over time. We also cover a number of important human topics, like what it means to lose community, the importance of communication and feedback, and what it takes to stand up for what you believe in, especially when the people around you do not agree. So I hope you enjoy this conversation. I give you Walt Fritz. All right. Thank you, Walt. I appreciate you joining me.
Well, thanks for having me, Haley.
Yeah. This is my first conversation with a physical therapist, so I'm excited for this opportunity. So let's jump right into it. You obviously are originally trained as a physical therapist, but your work that you do is very hands-on. Is that how you were originally trained, or did that come later?
Yeah, in physical therapy school, we certainly had a fair amount of manual therapy training, hands-on training, everything from massage. We had an entire, like, one-week section of massage that made us licensed to massage, which is kind of frightening, really. But, you know, a lot of palpatory evaluative as well as treatment school routines from a manual therapy perspective, manipulation, mobilization, that sort of thing. So, I mean, physical therapists and massage therapists kind of, I would say, share a lot of common values and beliefs when it comes to manual care, how we go about doing it, and, you know, how insurances dictate how we do it certainly has changed my profession a lot. But, yeah, I certainly had my grounding in manual therapy way back in the early mid-80s when I was in college.
Hmm. And did that shift, did you kind of move more towards that, or does that kind of been about the same baseline?
You know, the first, I guess it would be 7 years after graduating, I was doing kind of the traditional PT mindset of what somebody like me does, you know, wearing the white lab coat back then and all that, with working in general hospitals. I did a lot of early intervention, pediatrics, developmental disabilities, that sort of patient interaction during the late 80s, very early 90s, until about 1992, when I kind of was... had my arm twisted to take some myofascial release training by a therapist that I was working with at an early intervention center. And I really liked what I learned in those trainings. From there, you know, things kind of changed a lot for me and really shifted the way I viewed how a physical therapist interacts, the potential and the possibilities of what we can do with a patient, to the point where for years I kind of just completely got rid of that exercise-based model completely. Now I guess the pendulum shifted back to the center. I'm still a manual therapist, as a physical therapist, using what's termed myofascial release as my primary modality. But I still believe in the value of movement. I still believe in the value of exercise. I don't necessarily buy into weakness as the cause of pain model like a lot of people do, PTs and trainers. But movement is very therapeutic. And I love to combine movement advice, movement suggestions with my manual therapy engagements with my patients.
So you made this shift, right? You had this class, this training where you moved more into myofascial release. You've had extensive training there, but some of my listeners may be a little unfamiliar with it. They may know the term, but not necessarily what it means or what's entailed by it. Can you give a short explanation of what MFR is?
No, I can't give a short explanation. I can give a moderate or a lengthy one, which is what I'm known for. But let me see what I can do here. Myofascial release is a non-branded, non-trademark term that can mean just about anything, okay, which is both good and bad, all right? Myofascial release to some people is deep, aggressive, quick strokes. Myofascial release to some people is soft tissue mobilization. Myofascial release to some people is almost a light energy work. Myofascial release to some people is slow, sustained, dry work. You never use lotion. Other people use a very thick type of lubricant so they can do a stroke without hurting the patient. It really lacks brand recognition, which is confusing for the public because they think they know what MFR is and they come to a practitioner who advertises themselves as an MFR provider and they're not doing anything that resembles what they had before, right? So for me, myofascial release to me was always about slow static dry engagement, stretching of the quote unquote fascia in a very slow, deliberate fashion. And, you know, I still do that same style of engagement now. I just don't believe most of what I was taught.
Hmm. You came upon a point where that shifted for you in terms of how you believe what was happening or what the community was saying was happening.
Exactly.
Can you talk a little bit about what that process was, why you decided to kind of part with the MFR community, which you trained?
Yeah, I'll back up a little bit before that, though. You know, I spent... from 1992 through about 2005, 2006, in the Barnes School of Training, I did all of his workshops. I worked for him for about 10 years, traveling around the country as a teaching assistant. So I knew that model extremely well. I knew the model of it's more of an energy base, more of a, I want to call it a metaphysical basis to it. They claim a lot of good scientific evidence, but you know, if you ask somebody outside the MFR field, to, you know, kind of take a look at that evidence, a lot of it doesn't make sense. They're using evidence that doesn't really apply specifically to fascia, to the quote-unquote release of it, et cetera, and applying it in a way that sort of perverts it might be a strong word, and I don't want to get myself in trouble for saying that, but I think it's pretty accurate. But yet, it's really effective work. We're taught things, you and I, I'm guessing, we're taught things that if we stood back and logically took a look at what was being taught to us, it may seem not to make sense, but yet we're having such wonderful results, wonderful efficacy, wonderful patient feedback, and we're involved with a peer group that has really strong support for what we're doing. It gets very difficult to challenge the model, to challenge the teacher, to challenge the beliefs without being ostracized. And, you know, I guess I played along in that role for a decade and a half until finally about 2005, 2006, things came to a head. And depending on who you ask, I left that community or I got kicked out, depending on who you ask.
Yeah.
And, you know, from there on, it was like, okay, what do I want to do with the rest of my life now? I still liked what I did from a hands-on aspect. I was just learning that the things that I was taught probably weren't the best way to explain it, the most accurate way to explain it. I don't want to say they were wrong because it really becomes a question of how your bias views information. But I was exposed to a lot of people outside the MFR community a little bit before that I talk a lot at length in my workshops about a lot of neurologically based therapists who viewed MFR as being really kind of a hogwash type of explanation for things. The work that we do can be explained in a lot of different ways from really well-grounded, pain science-informed, neurologically-informed viewpoints, everything to some pretty metaphysical, new-age, pseudoscience type of explanations. And what I did was kind of drift over there and sample that crowd a bit, the neurological crowd, and then work myself into the pain science approach to things. A lot of it made sense. I took some workshops from some other people. I took some workshops from some people who were probably quite a bit smarter than I was and seemed to have some interesting ways to explain things. The fascinating things about this is when I walked into one of those workshops, it was from Diane Jacobs, a Canadian physical therapist who teaches a modality called dermoneuromodulation. And I've said this dozens of times. If I had put earplugs in my ears walking into her workshop, I would have looked around and said, you know what, they're doing MFR. They're doing exactly the same things I do with my hands. But take the earplugs out, and they're explaining things from totally different perspectives, avoiding a lot of the pseudoscience, the new age concepts, and looking at it from a pure neurological and psychological perspective when it comes to the placebo effect, indirect effect, contextual factors, all those sorts of things. So what I think I've done is, in my beliefs and my approach, is sort of blended all this together into an approach that acknowledges that maybe some of that old information about MFR is accurate, but I think there's better and more plausible ways to explain the work.
Yeah,
so there's your short answer.
Yeah, right. Your desire not to say that what they were saying is wrong makes a lot of sense, because you don't want to by saying it's wrong, it makes it feel like the conclusion or the efficacy is in doubt, when in fact it is not. And in reality, finding a better way to explain something can allow you to achieve the same results, not with a clear conscience, but at least with a feeling like of being in alignment and owning what you're doing.
I think that's really accurate. There's a saying from that a fair amount of my friends use when it comes to the pain science perspective, that we may not be right, or there may not be a right way, but there's probably ways to explain our work that are less wrong. Less wrong in terms of plausibility. As soon as I say something like that online, you often get a lot of people really getting offended by that, because they believe so strongly in their teacher, the person who taught the work to them, as well as their peer group, the group of cohorts who has an online community of support. And when you come in and start questioning, or worse, you can really irritate some people pretty quickly. And I don't mind challenging people. I don't mind challenging people in the ways that I was challenged. I certainly don't want to insult or irritate you, but there's nothing wrong with being with somebody questioning what it is you believe. I think that's really healthy, and it's the way we grow.
Yeah, it's a way you can actually strengthen your argument. It's an opportunity for it to break down or get stronger. I think that people get defensive and angry often when it compromises what they view as their identity, right? If they base their identity as a therapist around these set of facts, and these set of facts come into question, that begs some deeper questions they may not be ready or willing to look at.
Yeah. And one thing I hear a lot is people say, I don't care how it works, as long as it works, which I get at some level, right? I was taught my work in a way that was really effective. So why question it, right? Why would I want to change the model? I think there's a couple reasons why. Not that you have to completely throw out what you believe, but if you can learn other ways to explain the work, it may lead you down new paths, new rabbit holes for greater efficacy or some different options. I think the other thing, which is really important, probably with the massage therapy community more than the PT community, is the credibility within the general medical community. If you're looking to receive referrals from physicians, physical therapists, et cetera, not that you have to put on a white lab coat and talk the talk and walk the walk, but to be able to communicate in a way that aligns with that mindset, I think it's important.
Yeah.
If you don't care about that, that's fine. I think, though, if you're looking to expand your practice, if you're looking for greater acceptance in the community, I think it's helpful to take a look at some of the neurological narratives that are out there to explain whether it's MFR, massage, or anything that we do, because there are other explanations for just about every work. You may not like the explanations because the words placebo come up, which a lot of people get insulted by the word placebo. But, you know, there's so much more to placebo than just the trickery of a little white sugar pill.
Right. Well, also, people assume that placebo means that they're not actually doing something, that they're not having an effect. But it's called the placebo effect because it has an effect.
Right. I mean, I walk into a room with a patient. They've heard the good work that I do. That's placebo right there. I gain traction from basically my reputation. I gain traction from how I speak to them, how I interact with them, how I dress even, right? Yeah. Those are all contextual factors that can actually enhance the therapeutic engagement. So why wouldn't you want to do that?
Mm-hmm. I want to ask a question about the dermoneuromodulation. But before that, you made a comment around mixing with the medical community, and it's a science-based community, right? And in science, the nature of it is you have to, the strength of your argument is based upon others' ability to question it. Like that's how you prove something works, is by having other people push against it.
Right.
So,
and a number of modalities that I've trained in, that's actually frowned on when you start questioning the authority. It's an interesting mindset that a lot of people They just put up with because they like the work. But yeah, you have to be willing to basically have your beliefs stripped down and say, can you build up a model that is plausible? Right. And I think that's what, but manual therapy, physical therapy, and massage therapy hopefully are all moving into.
Yeah. Well, I think that it on a personal side, it feels like it necessitates a level of courage, both on the student side, but also on the teacher side, the courage to speak up when you don't understand or you want to question something, and the courage to allow it to be questioned. And I think that there is holding both leads to a greater growth for both parties.
Right. And I think there's a third aspect of that too. I think from an educator perspective, the ability to say, I don't know, goes a long way. Instead of, you know, tap dancing or making stuff up, I think simply saying, I don't know, but it's a really interesting question I think it goes a long way.
Hmm. I trust someone more when they say I don't know than when they give me an answer that I am not so sure about.
Right, right. One of the things in terms of that, I teach a class specifically for, it addresses the patient population of speech pathologists. Massage therapists are invited, PTs are invited. I give CEUs from massage therapists on that particular class, but it's been a wonderful class for me because it's challenged me so much. I'm not a speech pathologist. I don't know what they do. I don't know what they know or the patient populations. And that's really the class that's taught me to say, I don't know, right? But can we build a bridge together with touch, with manual therapy, to see if we come up with an answer to that? And you know, that I just that's really been a good educational process for me.
Awesome. Well, yeah, before we go into the DNM, what are some of the things you do in the speech pathology classes? What are some of the things that are possible with manual therapy?
Well, the interesting piece is it's a lot of the stuff that I may teach to you as a massage therapist or a PT or an OT in one of my other classes. We're just applying it in a different way. In that particular class, we do a lot of work from diaphragm up through chest wall for breath support, for breathing, you know, in terms of respiratory disorders, but then we get up into the anterior cervical, the neck, the throat, the larynx, the hyoid, et cetera. We're dealing with issues of dysphonia, of dysphagia, swallowing issues, speech disorders, pressure feeling in the throat, issues of you know, post-cancer tongue treatment or tongue surgery, that sort of thing, all sorts of intraoral and extraoral issues. The fun part is again, I build a bridge with therapists who use this work on a daily basis. I don't pretend I know their patients. We're going to reach into the anterior cervical region, and whether I'm trying to replicate and treat an issue of cervical radiculopathy of a local, maybe a disc issue or a nerve issue in the anterior cervical region, I'm in the exact same area where I may be able to replicate aspects of a person's dysphonia, a speech problem, or dysphagia, a swallowing disorder. So that's what I just love. I'm passionate about this work. I think it's so cool that you can touch a person in one way and potentially impact so many different ways. And without getting too far ahead of us here on this interview, I use a strong patient-directed method of care instead of what I call an ego-driven method of care.
Hmm. I'm curious to learn a little bit more about this, the DNM
work that you do. Neuromodulation, yeah.
Yeah, yep. So can you explain a little bit about that work and what it says?
Absolutely. I'd love to give a plug for Diane Jacobs' work. She's been a mentor of mine over the last 10 years and a very patient mentor too. Diane has some interesting ways to view the body, to view manual therapy. And she, you know, if you kind of take that broader view and you watch us, a manual therapist, massage therapist, PTs, right? We're all touching people. Yep, there's little nuances of difference. There's, you know, there's quick strokes, there's light strokes, there's fat, you know, deep, heavy, all that stuff, right? But basically, we're touching people. But yet, we say we're doing all these different things. We say we're touching all these different anatomy beneath the skin, whether it's fascia or muscle or, you know, nerve, bone, joint, whatever, lymph. And then there's all these pathologies, both real and metaphoric pathologies. Real pathology is, you know, muscle spasm. Metaphoric pathology is a fascial restriction. There is no such real thing that you could prove. It's more of a metaphor for tightness in the body. So one of the things that I always admired about Diane was her ability to say, you know what, we say all these things that we're touching, but there's only one thing we know we're touching, and that's the skin. Can you build a model? Can you build a narrative of treatment, of evaluation treatment based solely on skin anatomy? And she has. She feels like she kind of can explain just about all the things we do as manual therapists from a skin-based model, both in terms of receptors, mechanoreceptors, as well as cutaneous tunnel-like syndromes from a neurodynamic technique perspective. So I owe a lot of thanks to Diane and some of the folks who teach the work for her and with her. I like to give credit where credit is due.
Does that mean that any touch to is it specific technique based? Like, is there a technique to the touch, or is it just an explanation of what's happening when they touch?
Yeah, there's certainly a technique to the touch, but yet when we touch, we're still doing the same thing. Meaning, I told you before, if I walked into her room, I would have said, "Gosh, they're doing MFR." But then I take the earplugs out and I realize they're speaking a different language. The handholds are really, really similar. The handholds being slow static stretching to the skin. Now, I was taught MFR that in a way that, no, you're not stretching the skin, you're stretching the fascia, which is a bit of a stretch, no pun intended, right? How do you know that you're engaging fascia? Well, it's part of the teaching process and part of the, I'll get myself in trouble here. It's part of the indoctrination process that you're led to believe that it's fascia you're engaging. Just like as a massage therapist, you're led to believe that when you do certain things, it's the muscle you're engaging. Chiropractors, it's all about the joint, right? Lymph drainage folks, it's all about the lymph passages, et cetera. We all get sort of shepherded in down these rabbit holes of believing that it's about this one tissue or one pathology. But then, you know, when you take the blinders off and you look out of your rabbit hole into somebody else's rabbit hole, it's like, crap, we're all doing really similar stuff, but we have such a different way of explaining what it is. And I think that's how I view my work. I call what I do myofascial release, right? But I don't believe it's about the fascia at all. I mean, the fascia's in there. It's under there. It's within us. But there's a lot of people who don't think we can selectively and singularly target fascia under the skin to the exclusion of all else. I teach this work, and I call it MFR because it's recognizable as a term. But it's not about the fascia. It's about the human being and everything that we engage skin and below.
Hmm. So you would say that it looks very similar to traditional myofascial release. Is there anything different about the actual application since your education with?
Sure. Well, remember what I said when you first asked what's MFR? It's non-trademark, copyrighted. So that becomes a tricky question because my MFR, whether, you know, can look very different from someone who's doing a shorter, quicker, more aggressive stroke. If you took a person who was trained in the model that I was trained and you took me and you put a silent video on us, we might look remarkably similar. Again, I think if you turn the volume on, the words that come out of our mouth would probably be quite different.
And is that because you'd be engaging in like client feedback more, or is it in terms of your explanation?
I think both. Plus, the model that I was taught was one where there should be very little talking. Okay, there should be very little talking because the belief was that here's where I really part company with how I was taught this work. The belief is that emotions get trapped within the fascia from an injury, from trauma. Massage therapists might call it muscle memory. We kind of call it fascial memory, tissue memory, that sort of thing. And it was taught that the emotions get stored within the fascia, and we need to allow the person to feel, to experience, to process, to go deep, to look at those old emotions and maybe let go in a cathartic type way. On myofascial release, the way I was taught this work can involve some pretty strong emotional responses on the part of the patient. It's not unique to myofascial release. Craniosacral therapy uses their own version, and a lot of different therapies kind of use versions of it, including psychotherapy, using similar types of models, but yet MFR seems to think they've cornered the market on emotional release. A traditional MFR therapist might be very quiet or might be actually encouraging the patient, whether it's actively or passively, to experience and express the emotions. And that's one issue I really have. I know my boundaries. I know my professional lines, scope of practice. I'm a physical therapist. I'm not a mental health therapist. I should not be trying to provoke an emotional response from my patient. Yeah. And a lot of MFR therapists say, oh, no, we don't promote it. We allow it. I think it's a fine line that's often crossed. So, you know, there's similarities between the traditional way I was taught. And, yeah, there's quite a few differences.
So we talk about getting the client to talk. And in your case, it's much more about feedback. It's much more of a conversation. It's less of a creating space for an emotional release. How important is client feedback for you? Like, how do you utilize it?
To me, it's vital. Therapists, and not just MFR therapists, I think a lot of us are taught a model where the more training we take, and usually it's continuing education, the more training we take, the higher our level of feeling of competence becomes, skill level, experience. I think the ego gets to really take over, right? Where we become the expert and people come to us for our expertise. Now, that's still what I do in my practice, right? But I think that that can go too far when you start, you as the therapist or me as the therapist, starts dictating how pressure should be, what the person needs to put up with in order to quote unquote heal, or, you know, really, really bad concepts like that. Yep, I've got a lot of experience. I've been doing this work for 26 years now, but I still don't know what you're feeling, right? You're my patient on the table. I can have all the experience in the world, and I don't know what you're feeling. I don't know what you're experiencing. And yeah, emotions do come into it. It's not that I push them away or I'm afraid of them, but I'm also not going to try and pull them out of you, right? I simply ask a lot more questions than a lot of MFR therapists do. Like, my favorite one is simply, what are you feeling, right? What do you feel right now? Not, do you feel this? But what do you feel? Allowing the patient to answer that question in whatever whatever way they want. And when it comes to pressure, those sorts of questions, instead of asking a question like, is this okay? Which is a close-ended yes, no question, right? I would simply say, I love 0 to 10 questions. It's part of my PT mindset, right? We're so analytical. 0 to 10, how much pressure am I using right now? And sometimes the first things people say is, oh, I hate that question, right? I hate the 0 to 10 question. Too bad, answer my question. 0 to 10, how much pressure am I using? And they give me a number, okay? Let's say they give me a 4. Instead of using that and thinking, okay, 4 is not too bad, it's less than half, we're fine, I ask a second question that to me frames it. It puts that first question in better context. I'd say 0 to 10, what number would you stop me at? What number do you think would be too much? What number would you not want me to go past? The person on the table who said a 4 might say I'd stop you at a 10. Whereas the next person who said a 4 might say I'd stop you at a 5, right? That person who said a 5, I was tickling that threshold. I was coming up against their threshold of maximum tolerance, which is not a fun place to be. And I'm not at all about provoking. I want to stay within your acceptable levels. So that's why I think whether it's a pressure question or pain question or whatever it is, the two-part question is vital to the way I work. That used to be how I worked for a number of years and how I taught this work. But then I guess I got bored with that, and I wanted to add some more. And I added another question. And they say, okay, they say 0 to 10, what are you feeling? And they give me a 4, what number would you stop me at? They might say a 7, right? And I ask them, does this pressure feel helpful? Does it feel like it might be useful? And some people have no clue on how to answer that. They'll say, I don't know, you're the expert. Well, but does it feel like it might be helpful, right? And some people immediately say, yeah, that feels great. Either you're replicating my symptoms or you're making my symptoms feel better. But if they say, you know what, I just don't know, then I'll flip the question around. Okay, you don't know if this feels helpful. You think there's anything about what I'm doing that could be harmful? And I really think that's an important question that we don't ask our patients enough, right? Does this feel helpful? And if you don't know, is there anything about what I'm doing that scares you, right? Because I don't want to make you sit here and take something just because you think I'm the expert.
The way you're articulating your questions is shifting our mindset as manual or massage therapists from the client experience being binary. It's either good or not good. Is the pressure too much or is it not enough? And as opposed to, like, there's a wide spectrum in here. The client experience, the client experience is huge, is so varied that the idea that it's either good or not good.
Yeah.
Is a way oversimplification.
Yep. A thing I've recently started talking about is the negotiation, right? I really do like working lighter, or a term I say is deep but gentle. Okay. We can work in a way that there's moderate levels of pressure, sometimes even deeper, but it's very slow, it's very nuanced, it's very tolerable. But a lot of people come into my practice basically wanting me to beat the snot out of them because somebody taught them that, oh, you know, this stuff is going to take a lot of work to get rid of. So do what you need to do to get rid of this, which that kind of scares me a bit, right? Because the patient's willing to put up with whatever somebody's willing to do because they think that's what's necessary. So I'm not gonna force my beliefs on them with say, no, you have to take a channel. I'm not gonna allow them to totally dictate the session by basically micromanaging me, but let's negotiate a bit, right? Let's try and find a medium in between where, yeah, that pressure, you're replicating my symptoms. This feels like it might be helpful. They may want a little bit more, but they're seeing that, yeah, there could be value here. So I see a value in negotiation that I didn't used to.
Hmm. Can you expand on that? Describe how a negotiation like that might take place? Because I know a lot of massage therapists come up with against clients who are asking for something that they may not feel is appropriate or helpful, and they don't know any other way of addressing it other than saying either okay or that's not within my boundaries, so I can't do that for you.
Right,
and
right.
It's, again, not a negotiation.
Right. Well, first off, I do have an upper limit of what I'm willing to do. I keep business cards of therapists who will beat the snot out of you if you want that. And I will give it to you, you know, and because there are patients who, you know what, they want something that I'm not willing to get. I don't think it's safe for them or me, right? How many times do you hear therapists complaining about their elbows or their knuckles or their body killing them because they had somebody who wanted that super deep, heavy pressure? Well, it's like, are we in a service profession or are we in a healthcare profession? In a service profession, you do what your client wants. In healthcare, you know, a lot of times it's the professional choosing, but somewhere in between maybe is the sweet spot. Let's talk about this. You're asking me for something that I don't think is safe. And here's one, and I can be rather sarcastic at times, so I have to be careful with this, but there's times when people come in and tell me about the aggressive work that they had in the past, right? And I say, oh, so you've had this back pain for a while. Yeah, oh yeah, it's been there a while. And you love when your therapist uses super lot of pressure on you, right? Oh yeah, you can't hurt me enough. And I'll say, you know, trying to keep a straight face, well, how's it working for you, right? How's it working for you? If that back pain has been treated in a way, in a super aggressive way, why do you still have it? You came to me because of my expertise, but you want me to do something that I don't feel is good for you, right? I think that's where negotiation can come in. I may apply a pressure that my patient says, oh yeah, that's part of my issue right there. You're replicating it. And I use slow static engagement so because that's the nature of my MFR, where you're stretching the skin, the fascia, whatever you think's happening under the skin, right? In a way that we're not moving past things. We're bringing it up to their awareness, allowing them to experience it, process it, whether it's their tissues processing, or from a pain science perspective, it's probably their brain processing that's accomplishing more of the gains than the tissue, right? But allowing them to feel it. And if I can get you to a place where I'm replicating your symptom or helping your symptoms, and that might be sufficient. Maybe we don't have to quote unquote, you know, break it up or beat the heck out of you. Negotiation that's the kind of negotiation I'm talking about. It doesn't work with everybody. Remember, and I do think massage therapists do have an issue with this more than PTs, is you're trained in a service profession versus a healthcare profession, that you're going to do what your patient wants because they're paying the bill. My patients pay my bill too. I just set different boundaries for them and myself.
Yeah. And I think that this is where, yeah, you touched on something really important, which is that it does feel like we're in a service industry, right? There's massage as a luxury, as a pampering, as relaxation, and there's massage as therapeutic, as medical or clinical. And
right.
Those two kind of are coexisting and figuring each other out. And some therapists cross in between. Some therapists are solely in one camp or the other. And there's both confusion on where some therapists lie, but also on the client side, on consumer side, confusion on where what they can ask for, what they should expect. And right. I think the client expectation is what we're getting at, right?
Oh, yeah.
What does the client expect, and how can we manage that so that both parties can be happy and get what they want,
right,
and come away feeling good about the session?
Right. People don't come into me for whole body treatment, or at least MFR is always said, well, you're supposed to work the whole body because of all these far reaching blah, blah, blah. But there typically is not an expectation that I'm going to do top to bottom, head to toe type of work. But if there is, you know, let's set the agenda right now. Why are you coming to see me? And whether it's a massage therapist or me, a PT, what are you here for? If you're here for your shoulder, how important is that to you, right? If I can help that shoulder, do you want me to spend this hour-long session with that shoulder, or do you want the rest of your body attended to? And if you want the rest of your body attended to, I'll almost say to you, well, how do you want me to apportion that time? Do you want me to spend half the time on your shoulder, half the time on the rest of you, right? Set the expectation at the start. They may change their mind partway through. They may love what you're doing and say, spend the whole time on my shoulder, but they may not like it and want you to go to the rest of it. But I got to tell you, there's nothing to me as a consumer going to a therapist, and I don't care whether it's an MT or a PT or somebody doing MFR or massage, and them not listening to me, right? And I say to you, Haley, my neck is killing me. I want you to concentrate on my neck. And you nod and you act like you hear me, but then you go about your own agenda. I'm not coming back to see you again, right? I guess I'm looking for this as less of a service industry than I'm looking at you as a helper, right? A healthcare professional. And I'm looking for your expertise. I don't want you to treat me as a routine.
Yeah.
There's so much good work when it comes to full body work. There's so much good work when it comes to the much maligned relaxation work that spa therapy. If you take a look at neuroscience, if you take a look at brain science, and you can walk out of that quote unquote fluffy spa massage feeling relaxed from an autonomic perspective for promoting parasympathetic response, there might be as much benefit from that as there is the quote unquote serious deep medical massage. But yet that's not a concept that's accepted in the massage community. It's that hierarchical type of tiering where the fluff and buff, the relaxation massage, is viewed as less serious than the medical massage. And I don't know. I think they're on par. I think relaxation gets short shift when it comes to brain science.
Yeah, well, I think that you're right about this kind of hierarchy that gets created. I believe it comes around, it mainly is due to the level of education and continuing education requirements that follow one model versus the other. It's
right.
easier to learn and to do the
right.
spa massage. It does not necessarily mean it's better to do one or the other.
Right.
As you
yeah.
said, there's a lot of science saying that the spa massage, in fact, is extremely effective at helping us, and maybe in slightly different ways, but can mm-hmm. be very effective. So I've been asking this question to all of my guests that have been coming on, and the main goal is to help dispel this kind of taboo or fear of both failure and sharing the failure. I find that failure is one of the greatest teachers, missing the mark, finding ways in which you can do better, as opposed to looking the other way. So from that viewpoint, do you have a most memorable failure or mistake or misstep when working with a client?
In typical Walt Fritz fashion, I never have just one. One of the aha moments for me was when I was still working from the old version of MFR and having an emotional response being sort of, it was viewed as sort of the ultimate expression of our work. The patient looking into their past and feeling and experiencing going through the emotional aspect of their physical pain. So much so that I felt myself really kind of pushing that on my patients. The expectation was that they needed to emote, that they needed to unwind. I think some of my biggest failures were the fact that my patients didn't see that as important. And I saw that as a failure for myself and a failure to them and probably as a failure to my teacher, because I bought into that model that everybody has to emote, or you know, the work isn't working. I got over that fast, right, when I realized that it's not a supportable model outside of that close-knit community of MFR. So that was part of the failures that moved me into this more neurologically explained model that I both use as a therapist and teach to other therapists. You know, and other failures are really, you know, is the glass half full or the glass half empty? The realization that as a human being, as a therapist in a professional therapeutic relationship, we can't help everybody. And that's so much beyond our control. I'm willing to try. I'm willing to give it all my you know, all I've got. But it, to me now, it's less of a failure than at least saying we tried. Early on, one of the things I saw about MFR was I was able to sell this in a way that I'm a PT. So why would you go to a PT who's charging you the full cash rate or whatever that is, right? When you can go around the corner to see a PT for a copay. And I said that, you know, within three sessions at the very most, something I'm doing should be able to help you in a way that other things couldn't help you in the past, maybe traditional PT or massage or chiropractic, right? It was a good sales concept for me to say, well, why should people come and see Walt Fritz? It's like, well, I think within a very short period of time, I'll be able to help you in a way that you can appreciate, so you can realize why it's worth spending your hard-earned cash for it, right? And that was a really good sales technique for me in the beginning, but it was also a way to say, you know what, I didn't help you. It's three sessions. Maybe I can help you find somebody who can help you. So instead of it being a failure, it's a recognition of you know what, there's so much more in terms of why you're in pain and you're coming to see somebody for help than maybe myself personally can manage in you. So I can't do it. Let me help you find somebody that can. Hmm. Is that a failure? It might be, but I guess I don't view it as much anymore.
And did you find yourself on the other side of that, where not wanting to admit failure or admit defeat? Did that happen?
Yeah. Yeah. I think in all honesty, yeah, I think it does happen. I think it's hard to say, I can't help you, especially when the person walked in and you're thinking, oh, this is right up my alley, right? This is tennis elbow. I can help tennis elbow. And the person didn't feel anything after three. Yeah, that, you know, there is that sense of, gosh, I did fail. You know, if you based your opinion only on testimonials that therapists put on their website, you would think, my God, nobody has any negative experience or neutral experiences with a patient. Well, it's because nobody puts negative feedback on their testimonial page, right? But we all have that. We all have people that we can help, or we all have people that, from a human interaction perspective, we don't gel with. Right, it's not a failure. It some people might view that as a failure, but to me, it's just part of the human condition. Hmm.
Before we go, what is the best way for people to learn more about you and the work that you do?
Probably through my website, which is www.foundationsinmfr.com, or I think waltfritz.com will take you there too. I don't teach a ton of different workshops. I am not a believer that one has to have 12 or 15 seminars under their belt to be a master. I think that you and I and therapists, we've got a good education, right? Sprinkle a little bit of new concepts, and whether it's technique or what the foundation for the technique, right? The science to explain it and learn new ways to engage. I think we can all learn enough in one workshop to start being good at that work. As a result, I don't teach a lot of workshops. I teach an upper body class. I teach a lower body class. I teach my neck, voice, and swallowing disorders class. Those are my three main classes. Just this year, I've been playing a little bit with some one-day workshops. The jaw and the mouth, we're doing one on the shoulder, one on the neck. I'm working on one potentially for post-mastectomy care. A couple of these little one-day ones that I'm going to be doing at various spots around the country. The easiest way to find my schedule is to go to the website, foundationsinmfr.com. I'm around the U.S. I'm up in Canada in the Ontario area. I get to go to Australia and Hong Kong this year for some workshops. So there's a good chance I'm going to be coming to somewhere near you. I also, if anybody's ever interested in hosting classes, I love working through hosts versus that really stale, cold way of working in a hotel conference room. I'd rather work at a massage school or university, something like that, and they can work out really nicely too.
Awesome. Well, that sounds great. I hope you come to the West Coast. I'd love to drop in on one of your classes. I'll check that out. And I'll also post the websites that you mentioned on the show notes so people can click through those links. And very good. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me, Walt. I really appreciate it.
Haley, thanks for having me. It's been fun.
All right. Thank you so much for tuning in today. If you enjoyed the episode, please go ahead and review it on iTunes. And if you have any questions that you had wished I had asked or topics you want me to cover in the future, please visit the website at www.housethepressure.com where you can send me an email and hopefully I can include it. Until next time, be good and be well.